Hello and welcome to Digital Hazard Podcast. Wow, the Digital Hazard for this, the 6th of February 2011. My brain shut down. That was bad. I guess, yeah. If you're listening to us live, which I hope you are, then you should be listening on the link that we provided over Twitter, Facebook, and however else you got it. Because this is a preempted show. Basketball is going on WRCT right now. So this is what we're going to do. I'll put up links in the show notes prior to every show that we're going to do on this stream as opposed to WRCT's stream. So just stay tuned to thedigitalhazard.tk and look for posts from me about basically... If there's no post on Saturday, then we're going to be on WRCT. If there is one, then tune in here, and I'll link the stream in that post. It's the same stream, but I'll link it every time. Yeah. All right. So in Egypt, their internet was restored. If you remember the big hullabaloo. That we talked about last week and all these protests that have been going on. The Egyptian government finally restored internet service after about a week of having it shut down. They restored it on the 2nd. So that was Wednesday. But, I mean, it really speaks to the fact that, like, no one should have a kill switch. And I said this last week, but no one should have a kill switch. I don't know. The article just says, like, about a week. But we talked about it last week, and it was early news for our show last week. So probably about a week, maybe 8 days. Right. You want to take the next story? Right. But I mean, that's kind of scary. I mean, I'd hate to be him. He was like dragged away by Egyptian police. Right. Yeah, actually. Yeah. You definitely see that. That's definitely scary for him, definitely scary for his family, definitely scary for Google itself. I mean, if your exec for the company of Egypt gets, like, black bagged, if there's political unrest in the country, it's like, as Google, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily want to stay in that country. Yeah. Don't mess with Google. All right. Wow, we hit two stories pretty quickly. But anyway, our next story, we should probably talk about this for a good amount of time. The TSA is testing privacy-enhancing software on the whole body scanners. So as opposed to really taking nudie pics of you as you try to get on a plane, they will, you know, sort of censor your nudie pics, kind of like pixelating certain areas, I guess. Well, are you suggesting something? Is that a rocket in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me? Right. Obviously they're currently testing it to see if you if the sa if the software if the censoring software, privacy enhancing software, will actually yield the same level of security as these surface X-ray concentrated scanners have been claimed to yield. I don't know, it I don't know. It really kind of makes me want to get the lead stitched underwear that has like the amendments on it. Yeah, I'd actually like to do that too. I have not flown in an airplane since we actually first talked about how the TSA was rolling out the low density X-ray body scans, the current crop of machines. So I mean, I haven't even experienced getting on a plane with these. Right. All right. Well, in completely unrelated news, but freedom. Okay, freedom of information, freedom of rights, you know, yada yada yada. WikiLeaks has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. Apparently it's the nomination is actually for WikiLeaks and not for Julian Assange, which I guess is an important distinction to make. Go ahead. Right. Snorre Valen, who is a member of the Norwegian Parliament, called the site, quote unquote, one of the most important contributors to freedom. My page just jumped. Freedom of speech and transparency. And if the organization were to win the Nobel Peace Prize, you'd sort of get a lot of criticism for the committee, the Nobel Peace Prize committee. Because we have Barack Obama and the Chinese pro-democracy activist Liu Xiaobo, who have won it in the past 2 years. Right. Man, you are just really putting up like a straw man argument here. Like, don't get along with the guy, so you just Tear them down. All right. Well, let's talk about something with a little more substance because we're running through stories pretty quickly here. Some hard data. All right. That'd be really difficult. Could we? Well, if you're gonna like not talk about Apple, then we'd have to do a show where we don't talk about Google. Because we have a ton of Google stories every show too. We kind of have a Google segment. I line them up in the show notes. Yeah. And this is on pre-orders. This is like people have not picked up these devices yet. Say that again? Yeah. Right. Okay. Right. I mean, but that's sort of the allure of the iPhone. You had people waiting in line days before the original iPhone launched around AT&T stores and Apple stores. And you had like block long lines for every iPhone launch so far. Right. I wonder, okay, so it's like Verizon has broken their own record for pre-order for like orders no matter if they're pre-orders or any product on the launch day. But I wonder because we don't have the numbers here actually. We just have they broke the record. If they've sold more Verizon iPhones in 2 hours than they sold like AT&T iPhone 4s over the course of a day. I mean, I don't know, the thing that I really sort of is annoying about these stories is that they don't give you like the random statistics that you might actually want to look at. Right. Absolutely. I said this in pre-show, and I'll just say it on air now. I really want to know the statistics for the number of. So this is the fourth iPhone. We've had an iPhone for about 5 years now. Come summer of 2011, I want to know how many 2-year contracts have been broken as a result of the iPhone. Obviously, AT&T doesn't have this data because I don't think they might, because usually people want to port their numbers. So I guess you could query AT&T for how many numbers have you ported over from other carriers to an iPhone. But I mean, like you'd have to pull data from Sprint, Verizon, T-Mobile to see how many people have broken their contracts to go get an iPhone. We've been drinking the apple Kool-Aid too long. All right. Yeah. Yeah, now. Verizon. Yeah, that'd be really interesting to see. Well, if you're one of a select few AT&T customers, probably one of you who stood in line for iPhone 1 on launch day, you might have gotten a letter from AT&T saying, "Please stay with us. Please. You could get a free microcell. We'd throw that in." I don't know. I find it kind of sad. It's like you come out with these microcells that everyone wants. You charge exorbitant rates to get them, except in the case of Dawn. backstory for those of you who don't know, a coworker that Eric and I worked with, basically got an iPhone, not got an iPhone, and then she received an AT&T microcell basically for free. Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Exactly. They should not be like selling these things or bribing their customers with these things when it's their own fault that they didn't invest in their network, that their network is not robust enough to support these amazing crops of iPhone, like amazing amounts of iPhones. It's like, why do you need to bribe someone with better service when it's your responsibility? In because like I'm in a contract with you, like I can point to the contract. It's like AT&T will provide me with service. It's your responsibility to provide me with service. It's like you shouldn't be bribing me with something that's in a contract that you're supposed to provide me with because I'm paying you money. Or they, I don't, I really don't know. I don't know what to say. There's the update to the article says that this offer isn't just limited to iPhone users. That instead the offer is being extended to all AT&T customers, probably if you've been in an AT&T contract for an extended period of time, maybe like 2 or 3 contract cycles, even if you don't own an iPhone. So yeah, sorry if you are like confused about what's going on. We're having some technical difficulties here back and forth between all of us. But you know, it's fun. We don't have to worry about it. We're on our own stream, so it's not. That's bad. We need to be professional all the time. Come on. Okay, our next story, and then we're probably gonna have to take a break. This is Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't open enough tabs. We're not going to take a break after this story. We have a few more. I just didn't open all my tabs. How about you take this as I open the rest of my tabs?
how hypocritical people are when it comes to Wi-Fiing and accessibility, where we want to protect our own Wi-Fi and secure it so nobody else can get on it. But yet, those same people are perfectly okay with getting onto someone else's unsecured network and using it when they need to, when they want to, etc. And so there's a nice picture here about the numerous, a couple examples of people who have named their SSIDs something to kind of, tell people, I know you're on here, I'm mad, get off my network. And I won't read these on the stream, but you can follow the link and read them for yourself. But stuff like no free Wi-Fi for you and things like that. I haven't done that before at all. Matt.
Well, the Wi-Fi Alliance interviewed how many people? They interviewed 1,054 Americans over the age of 18 about their Wi-Fi practices during December 2010. So this is in 1 month, the people who are going to admit it, and 32% have tried to connect to a Wi-Fi network that was not theirs.
Now, did I'm not recalling the entire part of the article. This didn't include this was just like home networks, right? This wasn't something like corporate or anything like that.
No, this is basically other people's networks in their neighborhood.
Everything.
Everything.
Okay.
It's that's I don't know. I mean, I'll admit it. I've the my practice for jumping on someone else's network is like when my internet is down. It's like, how am I supposed to find out how to fix my internet if I don't have internet?
I agree with you. I don't know, I haven't really, oh, look, this open network, let's, hop on that so I can't, don't use mine. If I'm home, why am I not going to use mine? But, if you're out somewhere and, oh, crap, I need to read an email or what, which is almost moot with my smartphone.
Right.
But there's just those so random stance instances where I need it on my laptop or and my phone isn't working with the tethering, and I've got to do this right now and then read it and then get off. I don't think I've ever gotten on someone else's just to get on for no, just to use it.
Right.
Although, if it speaking, is that article next? No, we should have aligned our articles better. A couple articles down, if you're in Canada, you now have a much better reason to do this.
All right, well, just go ahead.
Oh, okay. All
Nice
right.
transition.
Segue.
Fair
We'll
enough.
segue anyway. We'll change the order. It's cool. Canada, we've talked about this before, I'm sure.
Yeah, we've mentioned it before.
And it's the whole face palm and angry face and everything. Canada, Bell, the ISP Bell has enacted the first, downfall of the rest of the internet. Metered, bandwidth, usaged internet where, oh, you have 25 gig cap, oh, you have 200 gig cap, and that's it for the month. If you go over, no internet for you, or shell out some dollars to use it.
Right. Which.
So it's happening. It started with Canada. Thank
Yeah.
you.
We. This is sad, actually.
Well, and I don't remember if I said it on air last week, but I know I told Matt, we're gonna look back at this point in history and everything previously, from here and before to the birth of the internet was gonna be considered the good old days when there was freedom of information and everybody had equal access, and now it's just going the wayside. And
Yeah,
sorry about your luck, people who can't afford to get the 100 megabits connection, you get dial-up speeds.
right. If you look at the there's a little data graphic on the article, and so basically, it number 12. It's probably in an FAQ. What are my new regular residential DS internet options? And you see, there's one, two, three rows. For options, for your previous options, and high speed internet light, base usage included per month, unlimited. The internet premium, 200 gigs per month, and internet unlimited, unlimited. And then your new options are, and then there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different options. I mean, and the smallest is base usage 2, and then if you want the light package, and then if you want the premium, 25.
There is no 200.
There is no 200. There's no 200. There's no unlimited. There's nothing.
Yeah. Which it gets me so angry.
Yeah, it's really sad.
I don't understand how this is going to. It's almost like gas. You know, yeah. I mean, people are going to start getting as angry about this as they are with gas. And, you know, you sit here and say, how is this model of pricing going to survive through? But we've been willing to put up with gas and all of its horrendous fluctuations. So regardless of, you know, even as much as we hate this, I can see this surviving as much as I wish it wouldn't.
Right. Because I'm curious, I went and looked up 25 gigabytes to see sort of like to put it in comparison as to like how fast you'd end up like killing your bandwidth limit. 25 gigs is approximately a single layer Blu-ray capacity. The time to transfer at cable modem speed is between 0.4 and 2.5 days. To transfer at ADSL speed is between 1 and 1.5. And to transfer over Ethernet is 5.6 hours. And that's 10 base T internet. If you want to transfer it over 100 base TX that's half an hour.
And that's constant minutes. Speeds, man.
That's constant speeds.
A prime example of the problem with this is, okay, so take your standard family, okay? You got the family, you know, computer in the living room. You've got dad's work laptop or computer in his office. You've got mom's laptop and then maybe little Billy's laptop. You know, I don't think it's unreasonable to assume 3 or 4 machines in the household.
Right, absolutely. You know?
And assuming they're all the same OS, you know, they're all Windows 7 or whatever, they're all Mac OS 10.
Right.
You know, okay, new update, new OS update, and it's 150 megs or something. You have to download that 4 times.
And that's going to count. Or iTunes updating, 90 megs.
Yeah, screw OS update. You just update iTunes. It's almost the same thing now. But, you got to download that 4 times. And so one thing being accessed, which, you know, in the end, you know, people just run it. It's no big deal. Nobody's going to, you know, the average person is not going to technically sit there and be, okay, download and save to the hard drive and then run it, you know, locally over the network or whatever, or sneaker net it around the machines.
No one's going to do that.
And Windows 7, all Windows actually automatically downloads them for you in the background.
Right.
So it's not like, you know, it's even, you know, a conscious decision. It just happens that you're going to download this thing 4 times and it's going to count and you didn't really need to. You know, that's the whole idea of the internet, is you can do whatever you want in whatever quantity whenever, because it's all freedom of access and everything. It's a roadblock.
That's sad.
Yeah. Okay, there is my little soapbox speech.
Don't worry about it.
We're
a platform for soapboxing.
yes, we are.
All right. I don't know that I can soapbox about this story, but beyond saying finally. So Nokia is considering adopting Windows Phone 7. These are simply just rumors, but Nokia might be giving up Symbian, which we reported last week was surpassed by Android as the most used operating system for mobile phones, for smartphones. And Microsoft might be getting on Nokia's phones, which would put Windows Phone 7 as a major, like, if Nokia just sent out updates to all their smartphones and used up Canada's internet cap, then Microsoft Windows Phone 7 would be the most would probably be the most running smartphone operating system, because Nokia still has the hardware, the most hardware.
I too like this. It's, you know, I'm not a Microsoft fanboy or anything like that. You know, we all know I'm a pro Apple person, but that doesn't mean I want them to horrendously fail. We need good competition. I think it's healthy. So I'm happy that Windows 7 might get, you know, more exposure. I think it needs more exposure.
Windows Phone 7.
Well, okay, whatever. You know, call it whatever you want. It has so many
Yeah.
names. It's like a certain hospital I know locally that changes names every 2 years. So, you know, I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing.
right. The interesting thing is that this might be fueled by a personnel change. In September 2010, Microsoft Business Division President Stephen Elop stepped down and stepped up at Nokia. So it's quite possible that the infusion of Microsoft personnel is what got sorry, is what got Nokia to sort of bring or to embrace Windows Phone.
That, you know, and that show shows credence to how people in certain places can affect changes.
Right. Absolutely.
So I, you know, cool.
Right.
Nice.
I mean, like I said in the beginning when we started talking about this, it's like finally. It's Nokia's Symbian operating system was just so in the Stone Age, that they needed to adopt Android. They needed to adopt something to bring them forward, bring them into more competition. I mean, yes, Nokia has the largest number of handsets out there, but that doesn't mean that they're actually a competitive smartphone manufacturer.
Right. The time of roll your own OS, smartphone OS is long gone. Long gone.
With that, I think we're probably going to take a break, and then we'll come back with some Google stories and onto our whatchamahoozle, our segments.
There's a fellow.
right, welcome back. We are going to hit a few Google stories before we head into our segments, Facebook Frack Up, Science News, etc. So, there was a bit of a shtick earlier this week about how Google accused, man, as if the break didn't fix it.
bless you,
how Google accused Bing of copying their search results. And the way they did this was that Google set up a couple of sort of special character entries that normally shouldn't come up with anything special. But when you search for them in Google, you get a page. And then when you search for them in Bing, you get the exact same page, or you get the same things in the same order. So the example, they searched for torosapthy, I can't pronounce it, which is a surgical procedure in which the eyelids are partially sewn together. That's off of the first link on the Google search from Wikipedia. And then there's a link on the Google searches from medicaldictionary.thefreedictionary.com and then Surgery Encyclopedia. And then if you look at the first link for Bing, it's Wikipedia. This misspelling is not corrected, but Bing comes up with the Wikipedia article. Unfortunately,
with the correct spelling.
Unfortunately, the next two articles are not the same as the next two articles in the Google search. There's an Amazon thing, and then there's a cosmetic.md, which is for plastic surgery. I'm not going to read the rest of that. So you'd say, oh, well, whoop-de-doo, Wikipedia is the source of the world's information. And so, so Bing is a little smarter about correcting spelling errors. So then if you search for a seemingly random text, HIYBBPRQAG on Google, you'll get a link from the Wiltern seating chart and tickets to the Wiltern from team1tickets.com. And then if you search the same thing, you get an exact match on Bing from the same website, the same title. And then furthermore, you can search even longer things of random, seemingly random strings of text, and you'll get same answers on Google and Bing. So with this information, Google was like, you're copying our stuff, dude. Like, back down. And Bing's basic response to this was like, so what? Like, we're both search engines. Like, so we copied some of your algorithm. It's not like we copy everything. It's not like Bing is simply a redo of Google.
Yeah, I kind of laughed when I read this. It was funny. I mean, I don't know if it's just because it's Microsoft that it's funny or not, but you know, I'm trying to remember the specific quote from Steve Jobs, because somebody had asked him about stealing and copying designs and something like that. And he had some retort, which people have been flogging him for.
God knows that iPhone and iPad aren't original names.
I don't know. I do not remember what it was, but it brings that to mind. So if somebody can remind me, that would be awesome. But, you know, do I think it's a bad thing? I don't know. Do I think it's funny? Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, mostly funny. You know, is it malicious? I don't know. Is it, you know, peg me in the Switzerland category of neutral. You know, it's not really harming anybody, but would we like to see more innovation on Bing's part? Sure. You know,
I mean, obviously the first thing that Microsoft says is we do not copy Google's results. But then beyond that, Microsoft posts an explanation of how it uses more than 1,000 different signals to create its search algorithm. And basically, so they learn from all of their customers. And if, I guess, if you like have a Bing toolbar installed, or you're doing something where you've signed into Hotmail or whatever other Microsoft services you have, MSDN or something, and you do a Google search, then they probably pick up on what you just searched for and then what links you then clicked on.
It's possible. I mean, I don't know. Like I said, Switzerland.
Right. If you want to join the side of Google and try to come down on Microsoft, well, then you are probably one of 75,000 job applicants to Google in this past week.
That is a lot of applications.
Yeah.
You know, because it's every college, you know, this computer science engineering kid's dream. Oh, I'm gonna work at Google someday. Then you read this article and go, oh,
There's no way I'm
crap.
gonna work at Google. Oh, shoot.
Yeah, I read this. It was rather depressing for me because it was like, you know, I'm nearing graduation. You know, it's May 7th is quickly approaching. It's like, oh, sure, I'll put an app into the Google. Why not, right? You know, what's the worst that could happen? You know, not get hired. What's the best could happen? Hired, sure.
Right.
But then you read something like this, like, I'd probably waste money on the stamp. You know, really, I would like to see the HR person that goes through all those. You know, where's the HR team that digs through 75,000 job applications? How do you sort people out with that? I mean, seriously.
I don't know. I really
I
don't
mean,
know.
that's just a crazy number.
Well, let's see. They probably put like the MIT applicants in one pile. It's like, okay, these kids get an automatic bye to the next round.
They sort they have this pile called auto second round interviews, and those kids go right in the pile right there. I mean, that would be another interesting statistic. We got, you know, Matt, we should start a statistics site that just gathers data and graphs it and awesome sizes it, because that would be interesting to see the breakdown of where all these
Google employees.
applications come from.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you're talking about Google applications. I was going to say where the Google employees went to school.
Well, yeah, I mean that too. Everybody that's there now and in the history, and where the applications are,
Come
where did they
from.
come from, and where are they, you know, wanting to come from, you
Right.
know, because doesn't Ottawa Hills has where you came from has somebody that works at Google now, yeah?
Yeah, he came back and talked at Career Day last year.
So yeah, I mean
Yeah.
it's possible to get in, obviously. So I would just be curious. Do you know where he went to college?
University of Denver, if I remember from his talk. I mean, obviously I went to it. It's like, why not? So someone from Ottawa Hills succeeded.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, that would be an interesting breakdown. It would also probably give some insight into, you know, what they consider prestigious and whatnot
Right.
too, you know?
Although, like, from his story, like, he got in, like, when Google was young. Like, he was, like, the 58th employee of Google or something. Something, like, he was under number 100.
He was personal friends with co-founders, you know. They're at the bar one night. Hey, I've got this awesome idea. You want to go in on it with us? Sure. What's
Right. All right. Whoa, I just closed that tab. Our next Google story is about Android. So if you were paying attention to CES at the beginning of the year and you heard about the Motorola Zoom, the XOOM Zoom somehow, you probably saw or heard of Honeycomb, which is the latest update to Android, which was crafted for tablets. And Google basically said when they talked about Honeycomb, when they gave a Honeycomb press conference, that yeah, there's no way it's coming to Android phones. It's going to be simply for Android tablets.
You know, and I remember we've talked about Honeycomb before, and you look at it and it's like, oh, it's awesome, it looks great.
Right.
But also on that same coin, looking at it, you know, you say, there's no way this can fit on my phone. You
Exactly.
know, they did not design it for
For a phone.
phones.
And so, in a
So
way, it's a bit of a duh statement. It's like you designed it for a tablet, so why would you put it on a phone? But then you make the argument, oh, well, you designed something for a phone, why'd you put it on a tablet? And I guess the easy answer is it's easier to make icons bigger than it is to try to fit more stuff on a smaller screen.
exactly, and I think that's probably one of the largest problems with smartphone-esque devices is you have this tiny, what, 4-inch screen maybe at max. I think it's the Droid X is 4 inches, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Although you have like the Dell Streak, which is 5 inches, so that's a majority of the way to a 7-inch tablet.
Right, you have all this, you want to cram all this stuff into this tiny screen. I'm looking at my phone right now, and I have, start from the left, I have a little message envelope saying, oh, I've got email. I have the temperature. It's 29 degrees, by the way. It's super cold. Then I have a notification for GPS is on and, signaling. I'm on silent mode. I've got 3G signal. Then I've got all 5 bars. Then I've got my battery, my alarm, and then I've got the time. And there's like maybe room for one or two icons left in that title bar or that status bar, whatever, on my phone. It's like you can't squeeze much more into that. It's and on with Honeycomb, one of the things they did, which I applaud them, I'm going, this is sweet. It solves one of the major problems I know I complained about a lot, where they made all the home menu, back, and search buttons no longer physical. They're software buttons on the bottom. And because all the vendors would always put their stuff in different orders, and it's like, okay, so I just switched my Android phone, and I gotta re-muscle memory the button location. There's no room on my phone to squeeze those buttons on there, and if we did, they would be tiny. So I don't know. It just, I don't know where I went with where I was going with that. I guess I was explaining why it wouldn't work on a phone. So there you go, kids. Now you know why it won't work. Just so I know
Run
you're
home to your parents
curious.
and tell them you learned something today. All right. I'll let you take this story because you talked about it a lot when we sort of touched on it a couple weeks ago.
HTML5 video. Which, and I learned something right pre-show, actually, pre-show, technically. Remember last week we had this whole conversation of, oh my God, Chrome, no H.264 video, end of the world type, what were you thinking, Google? Well, Microsoft, actually, which makes it all the more hilarious because it's Microsoft on the other end of the spectrum, has made an extension for Chrome that re-enables H.264 video. Which, I mean, do you not see the irony? It's Microsoft, it's Google, they're rivals, they have their own web browsers respectively, and then Microsoft re-enables H.264. It's awesome. I give it makes me I told Matt earlier pre-show, I want to go out and buy something Microsoft just because of this. It made me so happy because I find it hilarious.
That's hilarious.
I laughed. I think it's great. I would be curious to see the amount of downloads. How many people download this thing on Chrome?
Probably a
We all
lot.
know Internet Explorer is the number one browser for downloading another browser. How many people download the extension for Microsoft as well? It would be interesting. As a backdoor, it also installs Internet Explorer instead of as your default browser, but at least you get to that H.264 back in Chrome.
Chrome. I don't know, the thing, but I don't know, this is sort of anti what Google wanted Chrome to be, because Chrome was meant to be this like one package thing that you didn't have to install codecs for, you didn't have to install plugins for, you didn't have to do the stuff that you have to do for IE or for Firefox or for whatever. And now we have Microsoft saying, Google made a bad decision. Here, try our plugin. Like
Well, but I honestly don't. That whole concept of a plugin-less browser, you download it and that's all you need to download. That's a great concept. I don't think it would, it'll never happen. There's no way.
I mean, even your Android browser, which now has Flash, you have to download the Flash application.
It's It's there's just so it, web is back in the day, which oh my God, back in the day, the good old days of the internet when there was animated GIFs and stuff like that. The browser literally was all you needed to get by, but there's just so many extras that enhance, the whole web 2.0 thing that enhance your web browsing. You can't just get away with just the browser
I
anymore.
don't know,
It's
but like
not possible.
the good old days where you could view page source and see what everything was, where everything was laid out, like what linked to where, like what malicious thing might be linked on this, like what might be linked on this site, what background MP3 might be playing, like.
Yep. Download moram.com.
Oh
Oh,
dear.
yeah.
That's really kind of scary. So
Have you been there, Matt? Have you been to
I
downloadmoram.com?
have not.
Oh, okay. All right. You gotta go. I have not gone there on a Windows machine that is mine, so I'm not sure I would recommend doing that. But you gotta go there. That's a precious site right now. I
All right.
just tell you that now.
So with this, we're going to start into our segments. First up, Facebook Crack Ups. All right. So our first Facebook Crack Up story is that certain airlines, including Virgin America, United Airlines, American Airlines, Delta AirTran, U.S. Airways, and Alaska Airlines, which isn't that like most airlines?
I was gonna say, certain airlines. I thought you just listed all of them anyway,
Maybe Frontier is the only one that I'm missing in that list. Southwest. Two airlines missing from the two airlines that you can get a plane get on a plane. We'll be offering free Facebook social network Wi-Fi hotspots on their planes in flight. Which comments like going back to the thing from last week where the Pope dismisses Facebook as not sinning. If it's not a sin, why are we addicted to it?
Well, yeah, because I, well, yeah, addictions are wrong. So, philosopher question I see there. And here, I was the first thing. The very first thing I thought of, and 99% of people are, TLDR, don't care. But how can I spoof other websites I go to seem like they're Facebook to whatever mechanism these airlines are going to use that allow you to get there? Because I why pay for it? Why pay for the internet access? It's supposed to be free, right? So, but no, really, delving along those same technical lines into the question, a more intricate, what happens when you watch a video that somebody posts that's, a YouTube
YouTube
video, but
click
it plays
in
inside Facebook?
Facebook,
Will it
right?
work?
That's a very good question. Man, we really need to get on a plane and like
Yeah, that's what
figure
we
some
need to
stuff
do. All
out.
right.
We need to get on a plane and figure some stuff out.
Okay, I'll get some tickets. We'll just fly to, I don't know, Cancun or Florida or something. And it's all for the sake of research, Matt.
Right. All right. So the way they're implementing this is via GoGo, which is a server side like in-flight service. And GoGo, the company, basically says that Facebook is the most visited site on GoGo, the most visited site from in-flight Wi-Fi. But the top task is email. So people are either letting whatever Eudora or off Outlook or Thunderbird download their email, or going to Gmail or whatever. So I don't know. It's sort of interesting.
And I think you were where I were a couple of minutes ago. Where was I going with
Yeah, sorry. Okay.
that?
Our second and last Facebook frack up story here is that a dating site, in quotes, very liberally use of the word dating, imports more than a quarter of a million Facebook profiles, which isn't that like half? Oh, no, wait. No, sorry. Wow, I'm good with commas, too. 250,000 Facebook profiles. I said quarter of a billion, 250 million, which is half of the users on Facebook. But no, it's only a tenth of a half of the users on Facebook.
That's all right. We forgive you.
All right. 5% of Facebook profiles were imported without permission.
That, you know, if anything, this serves, you know, the whole what they did was just really, you did that, bad idea. But if anything, it just goes to, you know, reinforce the whole security thing with Facebook.
Right.
You know, get on there and check those check boxes, please, because, oh, my God, some dating service just came along and scraped all your photos and stuff.
Right. I think it's facemash.com. No, what was
no
what was
face. The... Lovelyfaces.com.
Lovelyface.com. That site's taken down, so don't even try to go there and find yourself or a date.
Did they notify the people that they scraped the information from?
I really don't think so.
You know, so like I'm sitting there, right? And I'm one of these people whose stuff was scraped.
Right.
And all of a sudden I get this, you know, bloop, email from, you know, whatever, some random person. Oh, hey, I found you on lovelyfaces.com. That's my best girl voice. I'm sorry. You know, we should hang out. And like, wait, what? I'm not on lovelyfaces.com. You know?
I never signed up for a dating site. What?
Exactly. You know, that has got to be, you know, a hilarious surprise.
Right. The silly thing is like, their defense, like obviously Facebook is a little TO'd about this, but the group's defense is like, oh, it's art, not commerce. We're not trying to make money off of this. We're just trying to like steal stuff.
Right.
We're a non-profit orienting thievery corporation.
Everything we make from our stealing, we donate to charities.
Oh,
it's like Robin Hood, right?
It's
yeah,
like
come
Robin.
On.
Absolutely. The really interesting thing is the last part of their defense is we learned it from Zuckerberg because, I mean, this is what he did. He stole the Facebook of Harvard, like the book when it was printed, like on paper. Remember those days when like stuff was put on paper?
Wait, paper still exists?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That's what he did. He like basically stole it and scanned it in. So that's their defense. All right. So that I'm going to wrap up Facebook frack ups and go into science news. All right. Our first science news story is that the Kepler Space Telescope spots 5 Earth-sized planets in our galaxy somewhere. No, we know where they are.
So we got these images back, but guys, we don't know where they are. They could be 10 feet away. They could be 10 billion light years. We're not sure, but we know they're there.
Sorry.
Just, okay. That's funny.
Wow, we're really bad.
You know, this is what happens when you say, oh, you're not on the air. Guess what? Yeah.
Guess what? Yeah. So basically, the long and short of this is that these 5 Earth-sized planets are, like, obviously Earth-sized, but they're orbiting stars that are a little smaller than our own sun. So if we want to get off this rock, it might be a little colder on the next rock.
But, you know, hey, parka.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would, you know, if there's a mission that said, hey, you guys want to take a trip to another planet, but you got to wear a parka, I think parka would be acceptable.
Yeah.
I could do that.
The Kepler-Hubble telescope. The Kepler telescope has also announced that they found 6 other planets, all larger than Earth, orbiting a single sun-like star. So, I mean, Earth is the largest of the rocky planets here in our solar system. So I guess you'd have something where gravity wouldn't be 9.8 meters per second squared. But that star is some 2,000 light years from Earth.
Good recall on the statistic.
Thank you.
That's good. You know, hey, I'm all about, you know, this is exciting. This is exciting. I like finding new things. So, you know, woo, go us for finding more planets. I want to know that if, you know, let's get some stuff there. How can we get stuff there and see if there's life and whatnot? You know, it's 2,000 light years away, but I want it there now. Actually, I want it there yesterday. Somebody make it happen. I want to know.
FedEx. You just got to privatize interstellar travel like FedEx.
Oh, that would that be awesome if you're CEO of a shipping company and you say, okay, all right, so here's our new direction team. Space.
this, we know we've branched out and covered all of Earth. We can get a package from Cambodia to New York City in like a day. But you know, we've branched out. Now we need to move up.
Yep. Forever progressing forward.
Right.
Making progress. Space.
All right.
That's awesome.
In a similar news. Oh, sorry. Not similar news at all. Never mind.
Well, similar in that it's, you know,
branching out.
Kepler. Yeah. I mean. You know.
Go ahead. Just take the Save me from myself.
1,200 is the number that we have increased the count by with extra, you know, planet candidates, extra solar planets, I guess, whatever. That are small, you know. Exoplanety. I don't know. It saved me, man. I'm not doing so well.
This is basically a continuation of the Kepler story, the Kepler-Hubble telescope. Kepler-Hubble. Why do I do this? Man, I should not do another show for a week.
wait.
Yeah. This is basically a continuation of the story, which is I looked at it and I was like, oh, and similar news. Never mind.
It's the same news.
Yeah. Ever since Pluto was not a planet anymore, and it's been an exoplanet, we found a bunch of exoplanets.
Yeah, well, you know, really, I don't know.
All right.
Exoplanet. When you make a new category, of course you're going to magically find things to then
to
go
fit
into
the category.
Right. It's just, you know. All right.
Google is bringing its Street View inside. There is the Art Project, which is, you can find it at googleartproject.com, which is basically like taking tours of like the world's greatest galleries.
This is exciting. If you look at the technical piece of it, 7 billion pixels per image on average.
That is amazing.
Really? Like, why can we even get that good of detail if we, you know, like pressed our eyeball up against the piece of art? I don't even know, you know, because really you're standing there and usually some of those art pieces have these ropes. You can't get, you know, so close or whatever. You might be able to see them better with this image than you would be in person.
Right. And so, it's like,
that's really cool.
Yeah.
On the flip side of that coin, one of the first things I thought about was, you know, everybody hide your kids, hide your wife, and hide your husbands because they're photographing everybody out there, you know. Don't come into my house and start taking virtual tours, you know. Please do not extend street-level mapping that far.
All right. Well, there's actually a tie to you and I in this story, is that Brian Kennedy, who's the director of the Toledo Museum of Art in Ohio, said that these gigapixel images will bring out details that might not be visible to ordinary museum goers in a gallery.
There you are. See?
I didn't know that Brian Kennedy was the director of the Toledo Museum of Art. I just knew the Toledo Museum of Art. Sorry. Sorry. Okay. Last science news story before we get into an email, which is amazing, but we'll do the last science news story first. South Carolina scientists are working to grow meat in a lab.
Yum.
Please don't write in commenting on this. I don't really want to comment on this. I just want to like share it with you all and be like, hey, they're growing meat where you don't have to maliciously slaughter animals anymore to get your burger. We can simply grow animals' meat.
Yum. You know, and a lot of people think, ew, you know, it's disgusting, and you know, I don't know. You know, I don't know. It's food. If
Yeah.
it tastes the same, does it really matter? I don't know.
I think it's supposed to taste the same. I mean, I haven't had grown meat, but
I mean, seriously, if anything, in theory, it could taste better because we could manipulate it to, you know, not have imperfections or whatever, you know.
right. And you could cater a certain amount of fat content in the meat.
Exactly, you know.
Although that's going to end up with people eating meat and getting fatter, but you know, one or the other.
Okay, so here you go. Now, how can we combat obesity by putting in some sort of chemical in the meat that does, you know, there? That's the next privatized anti-weight loss thing, or not anti-weight loss. It'd be weight loss, because anti-weight loss would be weight gain. You know what I meant. You know what I meant. Whatever. You know.
Yeah.
Don't judge me.
All right. How would you take the email? I'm gonna make you take the email.
Okay. You want me to read the
Yes, just
email?
read the email.
Okay, I'll just read the email. Starts up says, a friend showed me this article. River of IP version 4 addresses officially runs dry, and I thought it fit well following up what you guys talked about last week. Since you know, we talked about IP version 4 of technically ending last week. Continues, says basically they've given away the last IP version 4 address box. We still haven't run out of IP addresses yet, but once the internet registries won't have any new addresses to give out after this batch, we are effectively, you know, out. So that is at least until IP version 6 is introduced with IP addresses. There are 39 digits instead of 12. But I did have a few questions, though. The article said that of the 4.3 billion addresses available with IP version 4, 3.7 billion of them were unusable. Which, you know, you subtract that, you know, amount, and it's like, whoa, it's you know, it seems kind of small, even though it's still a billion number. Can you explain why that is? The last five blocks were also split between five different internet registries, but yet with projected use, some of these registries will run out of addresses almost a year before others. Why wasn't there some priority given to, for example, the Asia Pacific RIR, APNIC, who is, according to the article, going to run out of addresses within months? Versus, you know, some of them who wouldn't, you know, a longer time. It also mentions that things like video chatting will be made more difficult if you end up having to share your IP address. What does that really mean for the average Joe, and how would we know if we were using a shared IP? Thanks.
Well, the last question, Eric and I sat during pre-show and tried to figure out, like, what would be a real example of if I have a shared IP that I would actually end up being able to figure out that I had a shared IP. And we really couldn't come up with a good example that we know would actually work.
Yeah, that would actually prove, you know, other than physically going to your neighbor's house and, you know, oh, and going to, you know, IP Chicken and checking your
Checking their
external
IP,
address,
right.
how could you prove this? And it gets dicey. It gets dicey. You know, going back to all the theory that, you know, we're taught, it's, you know, you never for you know, it's always like never do this. So, you know, you would never even explore it. You know, you never even test it because, you know, dual IP address is bad. You know, it will technically work if you put the same IP address on
Two different
two, you know,
machines.
machines in the public address space.
Right.
It would just be horribly conflicting, and packets would get sent to the wrong place, and then they would get dropped, and so the
And
other, you
you'd
know.
end up with a really difficult video conversation. Like if audio transmission is really sort of difficult to make sure that actually it ends up in the right order, the packets. And video is even more difficult, which is why, like, if you are on Skype and you're talking with the video, you have grainy picture and sort of grainy sound because it's even more difficult to make sure that the pixels arrive when they're supposed to, that they line up, and things like that. So if you have this environment where it's much, much more likely to drop packets, then you're going to end up with even worse Skype calls.
Yeah, it's not only do so if you look at if you think about this, and it's really amazing the speed of which machines process data. You have to take this audio, you have to take this video, you have to encode it and chop it up into a million tiny little pieces, and shove it out onto the wire or wireless, radio waves.
Right.
And it has to be transmitted, all these great distances. My voice is going from Toledo, Ohio to Pittsburgh, and Matt and I are basically, there's some delay, but you don't really notice it compared to being in the same, room. That's about the only time you notice. It goes all the way there, and then it has to be reconstructed and pieced back together
In the right order.
in the right order. If there's, and if pieces didn't get there, it doesn't have time to say, okay, retransmit, because by that time we're already on to the next word and it can't retransmit that.
Right.
So that's where you get the degradation from. But it has to do it so quickly. And you most of the time, if it were to drop, you wouldn't notice it. You drop one or two packets, you're going to lose, milliseconds worth of audio, so it's no big deal. But once you start adding the shared IP, where you start losing more and more and more and more, it gets choppier and choppier and less quality. So that's why it loses quality.
Right. And then, as to answer the question about why there was no priority given to the more used or the more populous areas of the more machine IP populous areas, it's that if you once you basically once you allocate a certain amount, you can't and then you end up, oh, there's some that aren't used. You can't chop it off and push it into someone else who needs it. I mean, if you the it's just like the phone system. They say if New York needs more phone numbers, they can't get some unused Wyoming ones.
Exactly. I mean, technically you could route it, but that would be a horrible, horrible, horrible
Right.
idea. I mean, it's pot because the what would happen if you were to do that in the telephone system is, so you dial this Wyoming number that actually exists in New York. The call is going to go to Wyoming first, and then Wyoming's going to be like, oh, this is a special number. It actually goes over here, and that's going to send it to New York. And there's this whole, path. It's feasible in telephone system just because there is no such idea of default routing and stuff. It just wouldn't work with IP addresses.
Right.
So
Absolutely.
I mean, you could do VLSM with different routes, but it's just, you just can't do that. Not especially in public address space, you can't do that.
Right. I mean, it's an interesting thing, and definitely this contributes to the fact of oh, we're going to remember the internet as it was, and
The good old
the good old
days.
days.
Yeah, the whole shared IP thing, it's going to be one of those pieces with, going forward, I can see another extension of that whole access, that whole, that we've now laid the groundwork for, paying more for better quality. Part of that better quality, I can totally see being dedicated IPs
Peace.
now.
Right.
You can pay for dedicated upload as it is right now, which, most businesses do, but I can see dedicated IPs being started to being listed, whatever, you know what I'm saying, on
Right.
those, pricing pages.
Right.
So you get, because people can buy static IPs, but it's, always assumed that you get one IP that's you, but
Right.
not so much anymore.
I mean, I honestly cannot wait until we have IPv6 and there's
Like a billion.
plenty of IP addresses. To quickly, if you look at the article and you look at the map, quote unquote, of IP address space, you see these unusable sections, which are 0, 10, 127, and then 224 to 255. I can easily tell you why you can't have an IP address that starts with a 0. That should be pretty obvious to most of our listeners. 10 is reserved for large-scale networks, internal. So you have a 10.x.x.x IP address within your large corporate local network. And then 127 is reserved for local host. 127.0.0.1 is your machine. If you type ping 127.0.0.1, you're pinging yourself.
Subsequently, you type 127.255.255.255, you also ping yourself. So there's,
Right.
all these addresses just for your own computer.
Right.
Why they, chose that, I don't
I don't
know.
know. Do you know why 224 to 255? Obviously, 255 is the subnet number, but 224 to 254? Why is that?
Well, yeah, if you had 255.255.255.255 as the IP address versus the subnet, you know, it's the end, it's the last IP.
Right.
So, you know, that doesn't work. It'd be like the global broadcast for the whole internet.
Right.
You know, that doesn't work. But the reason that 224 through the end there is not usable is because for whatever reason, they have deemed that as a experimental block.
Okay.
I'm not sure on the exact technicalities of why the IEEE did that, but it's the experimental testing block for public space.
Okay.
I don't know what they experiment on it with. I think there's some multicasting stuff that they experiment, you know. Back in the day, they probably did a whole bunch of stuff, mm-hmm. but I, you know, it was never really, to my knowledge, used anywhere publicly. So what it's, you know, why, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You would think that they could, you know, internally test with you know, private addresses or something for multicasting and things like that. And then all of a sudden, oh, look, we got a lot more addresses to hand out and delay it even further. Please don't do that because I want IP version 6 to come.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know. You'd have to ask somebody who's more familiar with the IEEE standards and whatnot. Maybe it's a hardware thing. Maybe it's a algorithm encoded in the hardware that we can't change now. I'm not sure. You know, okay. With how the network interface cards address that and, you know, read that.
All right. Thank you. With that, we're going to wrap up our show. If you want to email us like this wonderful individual has, you can do that at thedigitalhazard@wrct.org. If you want to leave us a voicemail, please do call 412-294-TDHP, which is 8347. And as always, visit our show notes, find the links to the articles at thedigitalhazard.tk. Remember, go there to check for this stream broadcasts as opposed to WRCT's broadcasts. If you don't see anything on thedigitalhazard.tk, that means that we're going to be on WRCT. If you do see something there, then that we will be on this stream. And with that, I'm Matt Barron.
And I'm Eric Boyer.
Reminding you to beware the digital hazard.